What happens when human reasoning replaces Christian thought?
We human beings can do this. We don't need revelation. We're good in ourselves. We can do this. And we can establish a world in which there's sound morality, where we understand feelings and history and experience, and out of that can come something new and better and grander for mankind.
Human reasoning dominated intellectual thought in the 19th century, and unfortunately, it made its way into the church. Today on Renewing Your Mind, we return to our series on church history. We're glad you've joined us on this Saturday, I'm Lee Webb. Dr. W. Robert Godfrey has been taking us on a tour through the centuries, from the earliest days of the church in the apostolic era, up through the Middle Ages, the Reformation, and now into the 19th century. Dr. Godfrey is a respected church historian. He's also chairman of the board of Ligonier Ministries and one of our teaching fellows. His lesson today is titled, The Intellectual Scene. Here's Dr. Godfrey now in the classroom.
Last time we were just looking in an introductory way to the ways in which Christianity had to relate to the world around it in the 19th century. And we talked about how Christianity was attacked, established, accommodated, defended, revived. As the 19th century wears on, thought both within the church and outside of the church begins to change in certain ways. And particularly as the thought outside the church becomes more and more a dominant way of thinking, and that way of thinking is changing, the church has to figure out how to relate to it. Is the church going to accommodate? Is the church going to resist? Is the church going to attack? Is the church going to profit from some of these changes? And so we have to try to follow some of those intellectual changes that are taking place in the 19th century. And particularly changes in thought that sometimes we call in a general and not very precise way, liberal. Liberal thought, accommodated thought. Thought that isn't strictly biblical. And sometimes in seminary, students will say to me, why do we have to study liberal thought? Isn't it enough to know it's wrong? And I always have a certain sympathy for that point of view. But what we have to recognize is that changing dominant thought affects the church. We cannot live in absolute separation from the world and how it's thinking and how it's changing. Some of you may have seen just a few weeks ago, I think it was an article in Time magazine, how many evangelical churches are beginning to accept the new thinking about homosexuality in the American scene. We can't think that the church can cut itself off from what's going on in the world and not be influenced one way or another. And that's why it's important to have some sense of the cultural forms of thought that are shaping what's going on in every time, and for us in this series, in the 19th century. Now, as the 19th century begins, the great intellectual heritage that it looked back to only a few decades earlier was what we call the Enlightenment, the period in which Europeans particularly began to have great confidence that they had broken free from the shackles of Christianity, of orthodoxy, of traditional ways of thinking, and that they would be able to think with a greater purity, a greater clarity, a greater independence, and this would lead to greater freedom and to greater sense of human dignity. And the Enlightenment stressed very much the use of reason to penetrate through to truths that were universal for all mankind. And so there was this sense of universal human dignity, the universal need for freedom for human beings, as the great motto of the French Revolution, you know, liberty, fraternity, equality. These were the hallmarks that the Enlightenment believed human beings liberated from the control of the Bible and of the clergy could come to and make life better for everybody. But by the end of the 18th century, there was a growing sense that maybe this confidence in reason and this confidence in universal principles that would apply to all human beings in all times and all places was too optimistic, too overblown. And even in the Enlightenment itself, one of those recognized as a great Enlightenment thinker, David Hume, began to ask if these reasonable principles were really so clear, so defensible. And David Hume begins to introduce an element of sort of skepticism about the universality of reason. As we go into the 19th century, reason is still an important authority, our thinking through issues. But increasingly in the 19th century, European thinkers are beginning to add other elements to reason as a way of helping to understand reality. It's not just reason, but it's also feeling. This gives birth artistically to the Romantic movement, to the notion that our feelings are as important to truth as our reasoning, that we can use our sense of what is right as well as our reasoning about what is right to guide us. Experience becomes a crucial category alongside kind of abstract, cool reasoning. The 19th century becomes a century where there's more emphasis on that kind of experience, one might almost say passion in life, than was true in the 19th century that sort of praised a kind of cool reserve. And in that 19th century, thinking also very important was history. Some scholars have said really what marks the modern world from the 19th century on is taking history seriously. Now that pleases me as a historian. It seems to me I think it was Luther said, we should all praise historians, we cannot give them too much credit. Luther was so insightful, so helpful generally. But what is meant here is we can't be so confident that there's actually universal human experience and truth, because we all have different histories. We come from different cultures. We speak different languages. We have different histories that have shaped us. We sort of instinctively know that, don't we? Today, we take that almost for granted, that people from different cultures think a little bit differently. They've had different experiences, and therefore they value different things. I was converted in a Dutch church, and Dutch people, especially immigrants, tend to be very straightforward. And then you travel to the South, and people tend to be so polite, you're not really sure what they mean. I don't want to be critical now. It's been very interesting to me to see how wonderfully different these cultures are. You don't have to guess what's in people's minds amongst Dutch immigrants. They just tell you. But in the South, you need a whole set of feelers about what people really want you to recognize as true, because it's a different culture. And it doesn't mean that one is better or one is worse. If you're from one, it becomes easier than figuring out how to live in the other one. But that sense of history as being critical to understanding humanity, to understanding truth, to understanding religion, becomes a key element of 19th century thought. And that combination of how much weight we give to reason, how much weight we give to feeling or experience, how much weight we give to history, is what makes some of the different accommodating theologies of the 19th century different. But it's critical for us to see that, because we as Christians continue to have as our default a confidence in the Bible. The Bible is true. It's universally true. It's true for everybody. Now, people from different cultures may read it somewhat differently, but we are convinced that the Bible ultimately has a word to speak that transcends cultures, that transcends feelings, that transcends reason. But we're living increasingly from the 19th century on in a world that doesn't really buy that and is more inclined to come to the Bible and say, Well, my reason tells me these parts of the Bible are true and these parts of the Bible are false. Or to come to the Bible and say, well, I feel good about this part of the Bible, it's helpful to me. I don't feel so good about this part of the Bible, it doesn't seem helpful to me. Or to come and say, well, don't you understand the Bible is a product of the history of ancient Israel and is a product of first century Greco-Roman world. And the Bible was important and true for those people in different ways than the Bible is true and important for us because we have different histories. Now, doesn't that all seem perfectly reasonable? Doesn't that feel right? Doesn't that resonate with your history? Well, I see some of you shaking your heads. Obviously, you're hard reform nuts. But but this is the reality that the 19th century began to face. And so some thinkers of the 19th century stressed certain elements of these notions. Immanuel Kant, one of the great philosophers of the late 18th century, died in 1804. Immanuel Kant said, what is essential to religion is the sense of oughtness that we have, what we ought to do. Religion is fundamentally about morality. That's the key thing about it. Truth isn't so important. Morality is what is so important. And he deeply implanted in German culture a sense of duty that built on Luther's teaching about the responsibility of obedience to the government. So if you are obedient to the government, have a strong sense of duty, that's going to help shape your culture. Other thinkers from this early 19th century period began to express the real importance of intellectually understanding the movement of history. And one of the really important thinkers of the 19th century there was the German philosopher Hegel. And Hegel had this sense that if we're going to understand truth at all, we have to see that it's always moving. It's always developing. It's always changing. And some have called Hegel's fundamental philosophy dialectical because there's always tension and conflict in movement. And so Hegel said, well, throughout all of human history, what you see is you start with a thesis, a situation, a truth, a reality. And then there arises in opposition to the thesis an antithesis, an opposition, a contrary point of view. And the conflict between thesis and antithesis leads to a resolution known as synthesis. And that synthesis then becomes a new thesis, which evokes a new antithesis, which leads to a new synthesis. And I'd keep on, but I'm running out of space. But that's what drives history, you see. History never has a moment in which there's a stable truth. Truth is always in flux. It's always developing. It's always in motion. And Hegel would become very influential on many thinkers in the 19th century, most significantly, perhaps, in terms of historical development on Karl Marx. Because Karl Marx, the father of communism, made great use of this thesis, antithesis, synthesis movement of history from Hegel to develop his notion of communism. So here's history at play, you see. History as central to truth. History as determining truth. That would become very influential, interestingly enough. I always say that, my wife says, you know, it's interesting to you, Bob, but we're not so sure it's interesting to everybody else. Interestingly enough to me, that kind of Hegelian approach had a good deal of influence on a very influential early German biblical professor by the name of Bauer, F.C., Ferdinand Christian Bauer. Now, I want you to be able to spell all these names. There'll be a test later. Bauer very much used this Hegelian approach to say, well, this has to be the way we read the Bible. Bauer said, the Bible inside is full of these sorts of tensions and movements and developments. Don't we see that in the tensions between Peter and Paul? Peter represents sort of the thesis, religion inherited from Jesus, and still oriented towards Jewish ways of thinking and Jewish ways of doing things. And then along comes Paul. And Paul's challenging Peter. Paul's the antithesis. And then you have a synthesis as the church works out this tension between Peter and Paul. Well, you know, you look at the Bible and you say, well, there were tensions between Peter and Paul. Not Hegelian tensions, really. But this is always the problem with a challenge to Christianity. There are always elements within those challenges that at first glance may seem to have something valuable to say. And that's why they resonate with people. That's why they attract followers. But Hegel insisted that it was the use of the mind that he was doing. He thought he was being very reasonable in seeing the way history is driven, history is developing. And he said theology is useful as long as you realize it's all a myth. You see, Hegel can't get in trouble with the German legal authorities who have established Lutheranism as the state religion because he's not denying the religion, he's just reinterpreting it. And this is what we'll see as a problem. These changes come subtly. As we look back on them, and I summarize them for you in 1 minute, they don't seem subtle, but they are subtle in and of themselves and have a huge impact. Another very influential theologian of this early 19th century time that I've already mentioned is Friedrich Schleiermacher. Now, conservative historians have always had fun at poor Schleiermacher's cost because Schleiermacher in German means maker of veils. And that seems to me exactly sort of what he did with sound theology. But again, he's the fellow that did these lectures on religion to its cultured despisers. He himself thought he was helping defend Christianity. And what he ends up doing is saying, Christianity is essentially experience and feeling. And he said to the cultured despisers, now when you're alone in a room, this is sort of a paraphrase, when you're alone in a room and you just settle down, don't you have an experience of absolute dependence? Don't you recognize you're dependent on another? Don't you recognize you're not sufficient in yourself? And he said, what Christianity has taught is that the understanding of that feeling of dependence is that you're dependent on God. You're dependent on the God who has been described for us by those who've had those feelings in the Bible. And therefore, those who've come before us and gone through those experiences help us process those experiences by what they've recorded in the Bible for us. So he's not demythologizing the Bible, or better, turning the Bible into a myth, but he's arguing that the real way to understand religion is not primarily in terms of morality, as Kant seemed to be doing, or primarily in terms of intellect, as Hegel seemed to be doing, but understand it primarily in terms of feeling. And in some ways, all these people thought, in different ways and to different degrees, that they were kind of defending Christianity, making it modern, making it relevant, making it useful today. And this is crucial for us to see that this kind of attitude, driven by a kind of optimism still from the Enlightenment. We can do this. We human beings can do this. We don't need revelation. We're good in ourselves. We're able in ourselves. We're accomplished in ourselves. We can do this. And we can establish a world in which there's sound morality, in which there's effective use of the mind, where we understand feelings and history and experience. And out of that can come something new and better and grander for mankind. And that tends to be then what's going on the European scene, developing through the 19th century, becoming often more radical, more critical, more openly antagonistic to elements of the Bible and received Christian truth. But this is sort of where the flow comes from. And while this is happening and developing in Europe, America is having a different but still parallel kind of development. And that's what's crucial, that America is not hermetically sealed from Europe and its thought. The great thinkers in America are reading the great European thinkers. And so as we turn in the next lecture to the American experience, we're going to see that the American experience in significant ways is different, but still has certain parallels. By the late 18th and early 19th century, American theology is becoming more optimistic. Now, that doesn't just happen in a vacuum. That optimism is part of what we've already seen from the Enlightenment, what we're already seeing as developing European thought in the 19th century. And that optimism will take a slightly different form in America, but it will end up being, in many circles, an attack on Calvinism. In the 17th and 18th century in America, Calvinism had been the dominant religious expression in the dominant denominations, Congregational, Presbyterian, Episcopalian. But in the latter 18th century and on into the 19th century, Calvinism begins to be seen as excessively pessimistic, as excessively tied to old ways of thinking and doing things, as excessively tied to the old order of things. You remember, America had in Massachusetts, in Pennsylvania, in Virginia, it had established churches. The Episcopal Church was established in Virginia. The Congregational Church was established in Massachusetts. And the Calvinist clergy were well-educated and used to a rather comfortable lifestyle. And as that old established church way of thinking began to crumble with the Revolution, as education began to be suspected, doesn't education just lead you to read those European books and confuse you? As the country began to move west and the educated, well-paid Calvinist clergy weren't so interested in making nothing on the frontier, life began to change in America. Calvinism began to recede as the dominant influence in American religious life. And so by 1850, the two largest denominations in America were the Methodists and the Baptists. No longer the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians. There had been a dramatic change that was taking place in America. The retreat of Calvinism, the advance of the frontier, all shaping and remaking American religion, driven to a significant extent by a kind of optimism that things can be different, things can be better, and our new approach, our newer approach to religion that will come to be called the Second Awakening in America, stands behind that. So that's what we're going to look at the next hour. As we bring this lecture to a close, we want to see there is effects of ideas. That's why ideas are so important as we study church history. We want to see some of the effects of those ideas in America in our next lecture.
You're listening to Renewing Your Mind on this Saturday. Thank you for joining us. I'm Lee Webb. And what Dr. Godfrey was saying there at the conclusion of his lecture really hit home to me personally, because I grew up in a liberal mainline denomination that totally rejected Calvinism. I'm so grateful that there has been a shift in my thought, and that's due in large part to this ministry, to Ligonier Ministries, to Dr. R.C. Sproul and men like Dr. Robert Godfrey. So I'm eternally grateful for that. Studying these things helps us understand the religious landscape that we see today. Dr. Godfrey is our teacher for this Saturday series here on Renewing Your Mind. We have been studying church history for the past several months, covering the church's growth from its infancy in Acts and now into the 19th century. This is a comprehensive series, 73 lessons on 12 DVDs, and we'll be glad to send it to you for your gift of any amount. You'll find us online at renewingyourmind.org, or you can call us at 800-435-4343. The series covers the ancient church, the medieval period, the Protestant Reformation, Rome's response to the Reformation, and much more. So again, request a survey of church history with your gift of any amount. Our number again is 800-435-4343. Our web address is renewingyourmind.org. Ligonier Ministries is committed to providing God-centered, God-honoring teaching resources for you and your family. RefNet is our 24-hour internet radio station committed to the historic Christian faith. RefNet is your source for preaching, teaching, scripture, news, music, and more. You can listen for free anytime at refnet.fm, or you can take RefNet with you when you download the free app for your phone or tablet. Next Saturday, Dr. Godfrey shifts his attention from the European Enlightenment to the rise of the American West. He'll explain the two American revolutions. So we hope you'll join us next Saturday here on Renewing Your Mind.